Deloitte Private, offering audit, consulting, tax, and advisory professional services to allow private companies to address today's challenges and shape tomorrow's opportunities. Connect with us at Deloitte.com/US/private.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Hi, this is Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNEF podcast. Today, we're going to welcome back two guests who have been on the show before, Maya Goldemer and Mallory Utigliano. They write about sustainable finance for us at BNEF, and they're going to provide us with an update on what's going on in their space. One of the key developments since we spoke to them last are the proposed rules to enhance and standardize climate-related disclosures by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC for short. We go through some important aspects of the proposed rules and how this might play out in the coming weeks. We also discuss the EU taxonomy for sustainable activities and some of the recent updates regarding nuclear and gas. And we're going to end today's show with an overview of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. The next episode, following this one, will be part of a special series with external guests from our BNEF summits, and we'll include an interview with Mark Carney, the chair of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, or GFANS for short. Note that BNEF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and a complete disclaimer can be found at the end of the show. If you want to read more of BNEF's sustainable finance research, clients can read it at BNEF on the Bloomberg Terminal, at BNEF.com, or via the BNEF mobile app. If you get to the end of the show and you like what you heard, and maybe you want to listen to the next one, don't forget to subscribe to our show on your podcast player. Now let's get to today's podcast on sustainable finance. Maya and Mallory, thank you so much for coming back to the show and talk to us a little bit today about sustainable finance and regulation. So Maya?
Hi. Hi, everyone.
And Mallory?
Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
We've got three female voices on here, so we wanted to make sure you knew who was who. We've got a lot of ground to cover. So typically on the show, one of the things we do is we think about one piece of research that our analysts have covered in depth. We dive in and we get into some of the different things that were brought up during that research. And today we're actually addressing three pieces of research, of which one is actually quite long. So we'll see how much ground we can cover. But well, let's start in the U.S. because there's been some interesting developments, and I'm going to be honest, I am not quite sure what they mean, so I hope you can shed light on that. The SEC has proposed some regulations. I'm thinking they're similar, maybe in some respects, to what the EU taxonomy is doing. Let's see if I'm right or if I'm wrong. What is it that the SEC is proposing?
Basically, to break it down, the SEC has proposed a new rule, so it's not finalized yet, but they have voted to sort of bring forward a rule that would change the way registrants, sort of filers with the SEC, have to disclose things like climate-related risk. And in my mind, this is really a watershed moment because the U.S. is not a super strong player as of right now in terms of regulating or setting policies for sustainable finance or ESG, environmental, social, and governance, you might hear that acronym a lot, disclosure. You know, on a global scale, they are well behind regions like the EU. So what this new proposed rule would do, if it comes into effect in a similar form to the proposal, which is over, 500 pages long, sort of describing the reasoning for their decisions and a lot of detail, is it would require registrants, I'll use that word a lot, basically, folks that are registered with the SEC, to detail existing and potential climate-related risks, the impacts to their business, and sort of the oversight and management of those risks as they see. They'd also have to detail any transition plans that they've made. So like a company who set, a public net zero target for, meeting net zero emissions by, say, 2045 or something like that, they'd actually have to sort of detail in their typical filing documents, their, what are usually financial risk-related documents with the SEC, what those plans mean, how they're planning to achieve those goals over time, what they've been doing, whether they're using carbon offsets, you know, a lot of detail in there. And then one of the, I think, the most anticipated or unsure elements, you know, something that was really a bit more contentious going into this, although all of it is really quite important, is that they'll also have to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions. And I mean, that's a pretty big deal in my mind. There, you know, entities are going to have to start putting numbers, you know, into the public. Many already do, but, you know, they'll have to do it in a uniform of what they're emitting. Scope one, really direct emissions. Scope two emissions, which are more indirect things like, you know, from electricity and heating. And then scope three for most entities will also have to be disclosed. Those are the super indirect emissions in many cases, you know, like what's being emitted by the products, you know, put out by customers, or what's in the value chain, or emissions from travel of employees and things like that. So there's a lot included in this new proposed rule.
Then the proposal is still in some respects in its infancy, is it not? So when we're talking about scope three, have they defined what that actually entails? And I know this is one of the more tricky things to measure for many companies.
Oh, yeah. And my understanding is that there was quite a lot of deliberation between the SEC commissioners. There's four commissioners right now. There, I think, can be a max of five. They were really trying to tease out whether or not to include scope three and to whom. They've put in place some nuances, you know, like a gradual phase-in period for these different types of disclosures. And scope three would come a little bit later for entities than scope one, sort of, you know, helping ease into the process by level of difficulty. But it's still very ambitious. And they use a lot of existing frameworks to sort of inspire this proposed rule. Things like the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, often called the TCFD, just sort of a voluntary guide for disclosure that is widely adopted and in some cases, you know, used as a basis for mandatory disclosures in different regions. And also the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. They use that to sort of base their definitions of what is constituted as scope three. And it would include a lot of activities. To your point about its infancy, yes, it's still unsure the final form that the rule will take. But I think it's anticipated that it will be somewhat similar in many ways to the current proposed rule. So basically what happens is they voted, the rule was sort of moved on to the next stage. It's now in a public comment period. They'll get those comments back at least through May 20th, if not longer. And then they will sort of take those into consideration, hash it out amongst themselves, reformulate sort of the typical process for putting out rules with the SEC. And then they will, you know, put out and vote on a finalized rule. We could see that as early as the end of the year.
So the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is voting on this and then putting it out for... What did you say?
No, you're good. So for public comment, so basically they have formulated this proposal amongst the different, you know, divisions of the SEC through the drafting process. And then there was a public meeting and they almost sort of presented it publicly, the details in a shortened form of the proposal. And then they, the commissioners, sort of those members who vote on the proposed rule, they sort of lead the SEC, and they're appointed by the president and they sit for a term. They all sort of gave reasoning behind their support or opposition of the proposed rule, and then they voted and it passed through 3-1. And so now, yes, it's going, it's open to the public. Anybody can read the document and submit a public comment, and then that'll all be taken into consideration before things are sort of rehashed and finalized by the SEC.
So, Maya, how does what the SEC in the US is proposing to do, how does this stack up with some of the existing regulations that maybe do rate more highly? We actually have a policy scoreboard where we actually look at countries and the different policies they have in place in comparison to one another. So that's something we look at BNEF. How does what the US is proposing to do in the future, where does it get them in terms of stacking up with perhaps the European Commission, for example?
Yeah, so what we're seeing right now with the US is that it's just the necessary first step to kick off a wider strategy. The US is really behind. And to be completely honest, and we agree on that with Mallory as well, this first step is nothing compared to the EU agenda on sustainable finance and the strategy that we are seeing here in the EU. It's an important and necessary first step, but for now, it very much looks like mandatory TCFD reporting. TCFD being what Mallory explained, which is the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, which basically forces companies to look at the risk and opportunities that are linked to climate change. And this is due to many reasons. The first reason is the fact that the SEC, the mandate of the SEC only allows them to look at what is financially material and look at and create regulations or legislation to basically protect investors. So their mandate is much more refined and small than the one of the European Commission and all the European supervisory authorities, plus the European Central Banks, because all the regulations we're seeing in the European Union come from everywhere. So for now, the US is in the third tier of the G20 countries that we've ranked so far. And it's most probably going to remain in the tier three, because this is just one legislation looking at one type of organizations, which are corporations as a whole, like all the registrants to the SEC. But it might probably push them to the top of that tier three, because at the moment they were more at the bottom.
All right. So then, Mallory, I want to ask you whether or not you think it's actually even going to happen, because one of the things I have learned over the years from discussing different regulations in the US is that you have things that are proposed and then a new administration comes in Washington and then things get rolled back. Is there any risk that that will happen and that any changes in the White House will have an impact on the way the SEC is actually functioning?
You know, as of right now, I think it's pretty likely that it will get through. As I mentioned, there's four commissioners right now. Three of them are Democrats and one is Republican. The one Republican commissioner, Hester Peirce, she voted no, but the other three voted yes. And basically the appointments of the commissioner are put in place by the president and then they serve a term. One of the appointees, Allison Herron Lee, who previously served as the acting chair, her term is coming up for a close in, June. But she has sort of put a statement saying that she will be stepping down at the end of her term once a successor is confirmed. So it's unclear exactly when she'll be departing from the SEC. But given that, you know, Joe Biden is the president and he is, you know, of the Democratic Party and there's room for more commissioners with and without Commissioner Lee, I think it's, you know, pretty much likely that whomever is or is not appointed before this finalized rule gets voted upon, because, you know, you could see more commissioners appointed before that time or perhaps not, that it will get passed in a form that is probably pretty similar to what it is now. I don't anticipate them paring it down too much, because I think the biggest hurdle was them actually putting a lot of this like scope three emissions disclosures in the proposed rule and sort of putting that out there. So it, you know, kind of behooves them to put it through. One concern in terms of things like rollbacks is legal action. So there have already been threats for lawsuits to, you know, challenging the SEC, which would happen after the rule is finalized. So it wouldn't be happening in this form because the rule is not complete yet. And, you know, challenge whether or not it violates the mandate of the SEC. As Maya mentioned, you know, astutely earlier, the SEC, you know, is sort of regulating things that pose material, you know, financial risks. And that's something that I didn't mention earlier. Some of these disclosures are subject to that sort of materiality clause. We hear that buzzword a lot. But basically, it's, you know, meaning that a reasonable person would think that information is financially important. And so it's a very strong rule, in my personal opinion. But it does leave, you know, some of this quote unquote materiality of what to disclose or not disclose up to the discretion of the discloser, you know, which can, you know, pose questions or not. I'm stealing some of Maya's European pessimism. But for this, you know, I think that, you know, analyses have shown that it's sort of likely that even if lawsuits were to be waged, the rule will probably survive in, you know, the form without being completely pared down, stripped down, you know, to its nuts and bolts and get through, which, you know, I think would be a pretty big deal. It remains to be seen how things will go in the future. But, you know, current concerns are whether or not, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions disclosure components, for example, you know, violate the rule, as, you know, the mandates from Congress that established the SEC of having to disclose financially material information, and whether it sort of oversteps by requiring them to disclose too much. There's also concerns over whether it violates the Constitution's First Amendment of free speech, because the SEC is sort of allowed to compel speech to promote transparency from companies. But there have been questions over whether or not this this oversteps that First Amendment as well. So we'll see. It's likely that lawsuits will be waged, but I think it's also equally likely that the rule will come through sort of unabashed and make it in a final form that looks very similar to what it is now and sort of reign supreme for quite a while.
Now for a very short break. Stay with us.
At Deloitte Private, our passion for innovation creates powerful opportunities as we advise our private clients on ways to stay ahead of change, to leverage technology to drive progress, and to transform disruption into lasting value. Deloitte Private brings the service depth and breadth of Deloitte, tailored specifically to the unique demands of privately held, family-owned, and venture-backed companies. Connect with us at deloitte.com/us/private.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So, well, then let's go back to Maya, and that you were calling it European pessimism, but I think she's just giving it a good dose of critical thinking and realism on some of these things.
Absolutely. Just a joke.
And she applies it to Europe as well. So let's then talk about the EU taxonomy. There have been some changes on that side and some discussion around incorporating gas and nuclear. Now, I know that you have some strong opinions regarding what this may do to Europe's climate goals. So Maya, why don't you lay out what is the problem here, and what is your critique of gas and nuclear in the taxonomy?
So let's try to make it short, because we don't have 3 hours in front of us and a long debate, you know, the French way with like everything, hands and stuff. Anyway.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here too.
Great. Ready for that. So there are two very different points. The inclusion of nuclear and natural gas have come together into the taxonomy, but this is more because of like diplomatic and political like reason. It's the fact that some countries were pushing for one, so others were like, you know what, if you're pushing for one, we're pushing for the other. So the taxonomy has been, the first thing that people need to know is that the taxonomy, the first texts have been approved, they've been signed off, they've been passed, they came into force. This year, companies have been reported their eligibility percentage to the taxonomy, and it's going to be full alignment next year. But then in December 2021, the European Commission proposed and put out an addendum to the taxonomy to basically create conditions under which nuclear and natural gas could be considered green in the taxonomy, within the framework of the taxonomy. And so after that, the platform and the platform and the member states have reviewed these conditions. And then after, there was another point where the European Commission has actually approved the text that was proposed at the end of December without any changes, despite the analysis from the platform and the member state. So the two facts are the inclusion of nuclear in the taxonomy is for any new built nuclear, but also maintenance of installation. The main issue with the inclusion of nuclear in the taxonomy, according to BNEF analysis, is BNEF finds out that basically there is no issue in terms of like announcing the decarbonization potential of nuclear. Nuclear is a very low carbon source of electricity, well below the 100 gram of CO2 per kilowatt hour that is requested from any power generation plants within the taxonomy. So nuclear, depending on the estimates, we range between 10 grams and 60 grams, but whatever the exact number, it's far below the thresholds that are imposed to in the taxonomy. So from the angle of what we call substantial contribution, we're fine. It has a potential for decarbonizing the grid. The problem that BNEF sees in the inclusion of nuclear is the aspect of do no significant harm. So for those who listen to us often, we did a session with Dana and Mark back in the days to explain how the taxonomy works. And for the taxonomy, not only should you prove that you're green by substantially contributing to an environmental goal like climate change mitigation, but you should also prove that you're not harming any other environmental goal, such as protection of healthy ecosystems, water use, waste management, any kind of thing. So you need to ensure that you're not only decarbonizing, but you're also not harming the rest of the environment. And with nuclear, this has been highly contested. So that was the main reason why eyebrows were raised with the inclusion of nuclear, because of nuclear waste, because of military safety issue, as we're seeing right now in Ukraine, for instance. So there are a lot of points that raise eyebrows. But the main point that BNEF raised about the inclusion of nuclear is that whether nuclear is labeled green or not won't make change in terms of if we are financing nuclear. So whether nuclear is included in the taxonomy or not, nuclear will get financed if needed. The reason why nuclear is not financed is because it's far too expensive and it's far too long to build. So basically, we're all saying at BNEF, and that's the point of our report, is to say, well, you've been pushing for the inclusion of nuclear. There are some big caveat in the way that do no significant harm is structured. We don't, like, BNEF doesn't push back on the fact that it's a low carbon source of energy.
But it's the risk. It's the associated potential for it to harm. I think that's an important distinction. It's potential, but not necessarily. It just depends on circumstances.
Exactly. And the criteria that were set out to ensure to reduce that potential were too weak, according to the platform and according to BNEF research. But for BNEF, our angle was much more pushing around the fact that it doesn't make sense whether it's labeled green or not. So that's the point on nuclear.
The concern with nuclear is the potential for there to be harm. And you referenced actually what's going on in the Ukraine and some concerns over actually nuclear power stations being taken over. Also related very much to this, in particular in a European context, but actually very much globally, is what's happening with gas prices, which were already high before that conflict kicked off. And now there is concern around security of supply of natural gas. Europe is very dependent upon natural gas at the moment. And it is, in many respects, I know we don't love this term, but many have referred to it as a bridge fuel or something that can provide assistance with providing 24/7, 365 access to clean energy when you don't have the supply coming from either wind or sun shining at certain parts of the day, month, year. What is the issue with incorporating natural gas and the important role that it plays within, you know, providing security of supply? And so, you know, I know, Maya, that right now what you're going to talk about is really, I mean, an opinion that we have put forward, BNEF as a house view regarding where this fits in there. And we can talk, like you said, for 3 hours about whether or not it should or should not be included. So within the stance that we've taken, if we press that a little bit, what is the BNEF house view on why gas maybe shouldn't be included in the EU taxonomy?
Like, all your remarks are great remarks, and they are the ones that are pushed onto us at the moment and that are pushed onto the platform. So The taxonomy is a green taxonomy. It's a standard to define what we call green in the European Union. It means that whether you're in the taxonomy or not in the taxonomy, you'll still get access to financing. The main stuff that it ensures is the fact that what's in the taxonomy has the potential to have access to preferential rate so that we can accelerate the transition, right? It's not saying we're going to make for now, like the European Commission doesn't have the plan to create like a list of what we should stop financing. And that actually can be a different podcast at a different point in time because we're also thinking about that. It's not about that. So the inclusion of natural gas in the taxonomy is out of context because nuclear is a needed source of power. I mean, for those of you who are listening to us and know our new energy outlook, who know the European energy transition outlook, you know that from our own scenarios, there is a role for gas to play in the transition to a low carbon economy. So that's no question asked on that. The main question there is to label a fossil fuel as a sustainable investment, as a green investment. And it's mixing up everything in the investor's view, because what Bina found out is that first, the criteria that are set in the taxonomy, despite potentially being hard to meet, some of them have such strong caveat that it makes them weak. So for instance, there is an annual capacity level of carbon emissions that is set for a certain gas power plant. That is a 20-year average, but you need to report your taxonomy alignment every year. So does that mean that you basically upload or offload all your greenhouse gas emission at the beginning of the life cycle of the power plant for 10 years? And then after, you'll be like, okay, after 10 years, basically, I'm going to be neutral in terms of greenhouse gas emission. And therefore, overall, over the 20 years, I'll meet that average. This is impossible to check year on year. So maybe we're going to have assets that are going to be labeled as green at the beginning of their life that are not necessarily green, because you'll see it just on the big scheme of the 20 years. That's one example. The problem is that it's as if they had pushed to get natural gas into the taxonomy for many different reasons, while it's not necessarily in that text that it should be. So in our note, for instance, BNF analyzes the fact that the role that gas has to play could be regulated by other sorts of regulations, but not by the taxonomy. The taxonomy is a sustainable, like a green, environmentally friendly, a green framework for investor, for them to be a no-brainer and say, okay, if it's aligned with the taxonomy, if in my portfolio I have 30% aligned with the taxonomy, it means that I have 30% of my investments are aligned with the Paris Agreement. And now it creates doubts. While at the same time, at the beginning of this week, the European Platform on Sustainable Finance, which is the expert group that like responds to the European Commission on these topics, has just put out a transition taxonomy. So why can't it be that? Because as you explained rightly, Dana, it's a bridge fuel. It's a fuel that we need for a certain period of time.
So your argument is that there is a separate taxonomy that can take this into consideration, but won't that confuse things?
I don't think so. I think right now, the main discussion and the reaction from investors, what BNF sees is that investors are just saying they don't understand anymore. The taxonomy was supposed to be this kind of pure green list that they could follow without asking themselves the questions, because most of them don't have a scientific background. Most of them don't have an engineering background. They don't necessarily know when hydrogen is green, when cement is green, and that was supposed to be our common methodology. And now, in the middle of all of that, you have a fossil fuel. So it's better to have different sets of rules. Bina thinks that this came up as well because one of the biggest criticism against the taxonomy was the fact that it didn't have a shaded approach. It was either you're in or you're out.
So hence the need for the transition taxonomy.
Exactly. This is why the Platform on Sustainable Finance and the European Commission still have a lot of work.
So much work to do. Okay, so there's that sober look on that. So we've talked a bit about Europe. We've talked about the U.S. and some developments there. Let's add one more thing into the show today, which is the Glasgow Financial Alliance, so GFANZ, which is fairly new. And it would be useful for us to just kind of quickly go over what it is, what it isn't, because it is going to be a new force within all of these different frameworks for companies and governments to look at.
Absolutely. And maybe I'll jump in on that because I think it's a perfect segue, Dana, almost as if it were by design. Because, you know, Maya's talking about, you know, the need for transparency and green activities and every great point that she's just brought up. And it's the same, you know, with the SEC. Investors have been asking for a long time for more transparency. That's part of the impetus for putting forward any type of rule like this, you know, whether it's a taxonomy or an SEC regulation or anything, you know, that runs the gamut, is that people are saying, hey, you know, we need more information if we're going to make prudent financial or other decisions related to risks, opportunities, decisions, what have you. And the same is true, you know, for the GFANZ, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. It is sort of like I like to think of it like a coalition of coalitions. Basically, a group or groups, rather, of financial participants, whether that be banks, asset managers, insurance companies, asset owners, and many others, have sort of come together in different coalitions to sign on to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 or earlier. And there are different types of, you know, additional goals that go along with that. You know, oftentimes you hear about things like, you know, the need for setting interim goals, not just saying, ah, see you in 2050, like, you know, we'll meet you there. But like, you know, things coming, you know, every 5 years or so, or at least, you know, one interim goal. There's different, you know, elements of these sort of voluntary standards. But generally the gist is, let's all get to net zero by 2050. And the GFANZ, which was initiated, I believe, in April 2020, sort of coalesced these coalitions, brought them all together under one roof or umbrella so that things could be streamlined. So basically, you have all these financial institutions saying, yes, net zero, me too. And then they're all working in tandem under sort of a similar umbrella to figure out how they do that. So whether that means, you know, figuring out how to call for more regulation, like we've been talking about as a group, saying, you know, we need more info, or whether it's about figuring out how to identify and calculate the pathways that they're going to do that. The GFANZ has set up several sort of work streams or priority areas, and they released this at the time of COP last, you know, October/November. And, you know, now they're sort of working on helping to enable that transition that many of these companies have signed on to. And they're still signing on to these initiatives are growing. I believe at the time of COP, it was announced that there were 450 participants or, you know, sort of sign-ons across the institution types. And this is something that I think we're seeing more and more is, you know, I like to think of it as like a bit of a wave. It's like you start out with something like, you know, green finance or the call for disclosure, and it's a few voices and it's, you know, not necessarily put into action very quickly. A couple of people are sort of crying out in the wilderness saying, we need more of this, or we need to set targets.
Just in that little tiny voice too. I hear that exactly. From the financial services community.
Exactly. That's how they speak.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And then it like swells, you know, all of a sudden all these voices join on. It becomes more of a roar. I'm not going to do that voice. I know that we're on the air, but preserve some of my dignity while we discuss this. But basically then you have this sort of swell where a lot of entities are calling for the same thing. Maybe they're setting out frameworks. They're trying to figure out their footing as they pave the way toward the future. And it becomes a bit confusing. So you start out with not enough guidance. You get to everybody wants the same thing. So there's all these different avenues. And now we're sort of in the last part of the wave where it's starting to funnel down again, but with more clarity. So you take all of those voices, all of these frameworks, all of these coalitions, and you're putting it under one roof so that you're not having everybody doing things with a different methodology, which is super important. You have to, you know, make sure that calculations are similar. Otherwise, things will be completely incomparable and we'll sort of wind up with, you know, chaos.
Now for a very short break. Stay with us.
At Deloitte Private, our passion for innovation creates powerful opportunities. As we advise our private clients on ways to stay ahead of change, to leverage technology to drive progress, and to transform disruption into lasting value, Deloitte Private brings the service depth and breadth of Deloitte, tailored specifically to the unique demands of privately held, family-owned, and venture-backed companies. Connect with us at deloitte.com/us/private.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Yeah, it makes it impossible for the investment community to compare different companies within their portfolio to one another and make decisions. And for us, the public as well.
That's exactly right. And something like the GFANZ serves as a funneling exercise like that. It takes a bunch of coalitions and says, hey, let's get on the same page. Because you can also imagine one financial entity, you know, bank, for example, you know, they might have an asset management arm. It makes sense for them to be doing something that is comparable across their different types of activities so that calculations are similar. And that also takes away some of the burden of things like reporting and trying to meet goals because everybody's sort of on the same page. And even if it's between entities, it's not the same entity. It just, like you said, it helps folks that are on the outside understand what things mean and things like a taxonomy so that everybody's on the same page about what is or is not considered green. SEC regulations, so everybody's sort of disclosing information the same way instead of just here and there with different parts included and different units, you know, in there. It helps breed that level of transparency that then will help us understand not only what the goals are, things like net zero, but also how far are we on the way to get there? Because we can sort of compare as a group.
So actually, I have a question for both of you who really spend a lot of time thinking about sustainable finance. That is the job after all. So my question is actually, we're talking about GFANZ, which is trying to consolidate and look at different frameworks. Invariably, the TCFD was looking to do the same thing. They're not the same thing, but was also looking to consolidate various different frameworks that are driving to an end. We are at a place where there are these moves to consolidate information, data, frameworks, create alignment as we head into a world where ESG is becoming less niche and becoming more mainstream. And the main question within this is this consolidation happening quickly enough that we will be able to capitalize on the amount of energy and interest that is coming from the financial services community at the moment? Because there are so many companies that are looking to better understand what their ESG strategy should be going forward and probably formulating their own methodology. They're buying data, they're coming up with their views. Are all of these frameworks going to get there in time? Will they be additive? Or will they be a moment too late?
I think that's the main issue. I was actually moderating a conference yesterday on that topic. And I think that's going to be the main concern of everyone. Because let's be honest, we create all these data sets and we build all these new regulations so that financial market participants can act on it, so that corporations can act on it. But in particular, investors and lenders and ensuring that they take into account social and environmental. In this particular case, we were mostly talking about environmental, but there is a whole part on social. They take into account environmental impact of their investment. Not only do they take into account the risk that the climate change bears on their investments, but all their investments is bearing on the environment as a whole. And the problem we're seeing is that the same way we've been talking about the EU taxonomy, but at the moment we're talking about this taxomania, because so many taxonomies are created around the world.
Is that the technical term for it? Taxomania.
It's a term that has been spreading in the market. Yeah, the one that has been used. And basically that taxomania, it's great because it shows that we're creating this common language. But there are some small discrepancies between one country and another. Like we saw the Russian taxonomy, the China taxonomy, EU taxonomy. Now we're going to have the UK taxonomy. South Africa is working on one as well. Like so many, I don't even have enough time to talk about it. But it's also going to be harmonizing all of that and ensuring that investors can compare one with another. That's going to be really difficult. The part on corporate disclosure, they could do a big effort in harmonizing all of that. And I think initiatives like ISSB, GFANS, TCFD really help with the harmonization and standardization of the type of data that we're capturing. But also, I hope that could bring a bit of ambition. You know, I don't want them to just don't do something because they're scared that the other one is not going to do or something like that. I hope it can fuel a healthy competition to ensure that we get more and more data on the ESG performance of companies and organizations as a whole.
Yeah, it's certainly not fair to say, well, then we should do nothing because other people are working on it. There's definitely need. I was playing devil's advocate there in a few different respects, because invariably I definitely do see and understand the need for harmonization in this world of lots of different taxonomies. So final thought on what the SEC is doing in the US. This seems like an excellent step forward. Let's play both sides of this coin, actually. So, Mallory, how about you say, is this a good initial step? And what do you see is the change that it may spur in the future? And Maya, where do you see this falling in terms of what additional steps do need to take place in order for the US to really be competing, if you will, with other countries with more sophisticated, or let's say developed, frameworks in place?
Thanks so much, Dana. I love that question because Maya and I often love to debate these kinds of things. So, you know, putting one of us on one side, one of us on the other side is a great exercise. So thank you. I think it's a great first step. And, you know, Maya mentioned earlier that we rank countries as part of, research insights. We have sort of a tool ranking the G20 on their sort of sustainable finance and ESG disclosure regulatory landscapes. And the U.S. falls pretty low. One of the things that we found in that analysis is that oftentimes for countries or markets that, you know, have been developing sustainable finance related and ESG disclosure regulations over time, there's sort of a natural progression. At the beginning, you know, picture sort of like a graph with years on the x-axis, you know, looking over time. The beginning is usually across countries starting with corporate ESG disclosure, just like what we would be seeing with the SEC proposal. And then over time, you see sort of a shift. There's no much more of a need to put forward new policies within a given country on just disclosure from corporates, because that's already established. And then you start with more investor disclosure, and then you start with mandating the incorporation of ESG into investment decisions. You get things like taxonomies. If we're thinking about different types of policies, you start with something usually like a corporate ESG disclosure, and then you build from there. I'm not saying that, you know, this couldn't be leapfrogged or incorporated into a big policy, but it seems like we're seeing something very similar in a, you know, nascent climate policy world that is the US. You know, we're starting out with something like that. That's just corporate disclosures, and they're going to move from there. It is pretty ambitious in my mind because it's requiring that scope 3 and to disclose on transition plans. So it's doing a lot more than just saying like, hey, if you think a climate risk is important, you know, disclose it. It's giving more specific guidelines that help aid that transparency and that comparability, which we were just talking about a question or so ago. So, you know, I think that this is ripe as a first step, because we've seen this in other markets as well. But one of the benefits of, you know, being a latecomer, even though it's not good in terms of climate stuff, is that you already have examples in place to build off of. So, you know, when the EU taxonomy was being developed, there was no other, you know, big taxonomy to look at as a as an example and build off of. But now we see that other taxonomies that are arising across the globe are hearkening to the EU version, because they don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's something that's been established, and they can, you know, they can get through it quicker because it's already been done somewhere. And the US can leverage its position as a bit of a laggard in terms of setting sustainable finance policies, because many other jurisdictions have done it already, and they can use that to their advantage. I think it would be actually very prudent to look at what other regions are doing and say, okay, now we sort of know the landscape. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're not going to do. Tried and tested by others, because it helps, again, not reinvent the wheel, but it also promotes that comparability. It helps you look at other regions and know where to align. And then the other side of that coin, I think, is a bit of the SEC proposal, and something they should do more of, is using existing well-established frameworks, whether that be mandatory or voluntary. So not just in another country's taxonomy, but also something like the TCFD. Many people already use that. You know, number of TCFD supporters goes up and up over time. And when you establish based off of a well-understood and respected, something that is, you know, comprehensive and thought of as being very reasonable and sound framework, even if it's voluntary, you're sort of already ensuring some buy-in, because there's recognition at the beginning. You're not starting from scratch. So I think those are a couple of good points in favor of, you know, what the SEC has done, you know, in addition to just the fact that they brought it forward, which I think is a good thing for promoting transparency for investors and companies and other financial participants alike. But also, they should leverage their position as one of the bottom third, countries that we rank, and use it in a way, you know, as you know, a benefit to get ahead in the future. I think we should have sort of a race to the top in terms of making ambitious policies that coordinate. And at the most recent COP, for, you know, when countries came together, there was a dedicated finance day. So I think, you know, I'll say this word again, but coalescing around country level, company level, you know, whatever else it is, investor level initiatives will only help promote the future sort of skyrocketing of these types of institutions, because everybody will be working in tandem.
The question here really has to do with, is it enough? Like, essentially what the US is doing, and not only is it enough, like what else needs to take place? Where do you see the gap between what the SEC has put forward and what is happening potentially in Europe and other parts of the world that have been more developed in terms of their stance on a lot of these things? Basically, what is the gap? What is the gap to goal?
It's a great first step. And one thing I've realized by working with Mallory is that it was a difficult one to get in the US. Let's put it into context. Under the Trump organization, the Trump administration, we were talking about preventing pension fund to promote ESG investing. And now we're moving to an administration that is trying to do stuff, even if what Mallory explained, it's probably going to pass at the SEC level. There is litigation risk afterwards. Like, it's a whole different world from what's happening in the EU, where we have like a market that is eager to see these regulations coming. But yet, even if that's the circumstance, I still can't say for me that it's enough and it's big. I agree with the scope 3 emission, but it's only if there are material. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of like playing with the words, like who it's not. It's almost like a comply or explain kind of legislation. It's not for everyone. So that's already like a big caveat for me. And the other thing is then what I want to see is that indeed, great first step, amazing. It's a strong first step. But now we need this to move to the investor side first and the bank side, because right now it's mostly looking at registrants, which are they're going to be reporting at the company level. So even if you're an investor, you're like report as an investor, but as a company, which is completely different than having legislation that are really going to force them to integrate ESG into their investment process, integrate sustainability risk in their investment process and also stop seeing sustainability just as a way to hedge yourself against the risk. So what I would love to see is also having legislation like what we saw in the EU with SFDR and in the UK with SDR, having legislation that says you need this angle of double materiality. It sounds like a swear word, but basically what it means is that how the US has done the first part, which is how is sustainability risk impacting your investments, impacting your business? Well, at the moment, they just looked at the business. In the EU, they look also at your investments and your lending. But how is this impacting, therefore, your future profitability? And then the second angle is like, how are your investments, how is your company impacting the environment, impacting the sustainability of social matters, for instance? And that's the point that I want to see. And then after that, having central banks stepping in. The ECB, the European Central Bank, just announced that they are thinking of putting capital requirements on the back of climate risk. That is a massive step. And I wish we could see the same in the US, because once the US will move, it would show that everyone can move. So let's play with the different mandates of the different regulators. The SEC has one mandate. Maybe like the executive power will play another role. And then the US, like the Federal Reserve, will play another role. Like, there are so many levers that we can act on.
All right. We'll continue to watch these countries and the different developments they make on these different frameworks. It's sustainable finance, but it's this fusion between sustainable finance and really policy in so many ways and how it's all interrelated that is so fascinating at the moment. And it does feel like there is this sense that there is change afoot all around as people are organizing and looking at ESG and taking it more seriously. So Maya and Mallory, thank you very much for joining and giving us such clear views on what is coming down the pipe and what we should be watching in terms of a few of the changes that are taking place in the US and in Europe and, well, I guess with GFANZ, which is in many respects global.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dana, for having us.
Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability of this recording is expressly disclaimed.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.